that type of budget, you should have two riders that are capable of winning. Because Chris, one crash, boom, he's out.
What went wrong last year? I crashed. I fell off my bike.
Halfway through the massage, there's a knock on the door, and it's Ryder, standing there with a cup for me. Made you a juice, Dave.
What's quite worrying is we're still in Derbyshire, and it feels like we've been cycling for a week.
Morale good, though?
No, not really.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And not Lionel, Ned Bolting.
Hello, Richard.
Ned standing for Lionel, but we can hear immediately from Lionel, who has got his weekly roundup. Let's hear from you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. Another busy week of racing. The Spaniard Alejandro Valverde celebrated his 35th birthday by winning Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège in the same week. That brought the Spring Classic season to a close, and it was the ninth time in history that the same rider has won both races in the same season. It's also the second time Valverde has achieved that feat. Perhaps more notable, though, was that the runner-up in both of those races was the 22-year-old Frenchman Julien Alaphilippe of the Etix Quick-Step team. Meanwhile, Anna van der Breggen of the Netherlands won the women's Flèche Wallonne. And over in Italy, Richie Porte completed his Giro d'Italia preparations by winning the Giro del Trentino and continuing a very fine run of stage race results so far this season. He's been second at the Tour Down Under, fourth at the Tour of the Algarve, first at Paris-Nice and the Tour of Catalonia, and now first again at Italy. So he goes into the Giro in great shape. Two other races are also underway and will conclude at the weekend. Mark Cavendish won the opening two stages of the Tour of Turkey after his return from illness. Meanwhile, has anyone seen Marcel Kittel? Answers on a postcard, please. Davide Rebellin gave a glimpse of the future, a very promising future, I'm sure, when he won the toughest stage of the Tour of Turkey to take the overall lead. The 43-year-old Italian, who, like Valverde, has served a two-year suspension for anti-doping violations, turned professional after the 1992 Olympics, when Julien Alaphilippe was just 2 months old. Team Sky won the team time trial that kicked off the Tour of Romandy, where Chris Froome is hoping to carry on their three-year winning streak after a victory for Bradley Wiggins in 2012 and two wins for Froome himself. Coming up at the weekend is Alex Dowsett's world hour record attempt, which was postponed in February after he broke his collarbone in a training crash. Dowsett goes at Manchester Velodrome on Saturday afternoon. And finally, off the bike, the Astana team has had another reprieve after the commission decided they should not be stripped of their UCI licence. Not yet, at least. More of that coming up.
Thank you, Lionel, for that. Lionel will be back next week. But Ned, thank you very much for joining us today. Look like you're dressed for some physical activity.
Running, it's called running. It's what people do who aren't into cycling as much.
You're a cyclist as well.
Yeah, no, I'm a cyclist as well. I'm just about to, we're an hour late starting this podcast. But when we're done, I'm going to run home. That's the deal.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I'm actually en route back from Mallorca. I've spent the weekend cycling in Mallorca with my dad and some of his mates.
Why?
It was fun. But it meant I only saw a little bit of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, unfortunately, on Sunday. So we'll start off this week's podcast talking about Liège-Bastogne-Liège. There's lots more to talk about, including the Tour of Yorkshire, which is coming up this weekend, the inaugural Tour of Yorkshire. And we'll talk also about the latest sort of Astana news. Liège-Bastogne-Liège, the one by our old friend Alejandro Valverde. Ned, did you see much of Liège-Bastogne-Liège?
I saw the closing sort of 30k, which is... I missed the kind of rainy, crashy bit that did so much damage earlier on in the race, which was a shame for all concerned. But it was another Ardennes classic that kind of disappointed, as they seem to do annually. It's odd, the block of one-day races, they get worse. They're kind of, you know, when they first come along, they're really interesting and the weather's terrible and the parkour just... I think there's something about the fields and the way they raced. They just produce really exciting, unpredictable, difficult to read, tactically interesting races. And then by the time you get to the Ardennes, there's a culture of kind of racing that works contrary to what you expect, because the parkour could produce exciting racing, but invariably doesn't. And that was the case certainly in Flèche and also in Liège, I thought, this time around as well.
I think we've mentioned it before, there's a pattern, certainly in terms of watching, for instance, Flèche Wallonne. People who are fairly new to watching bike racing see it for the first time, think it's the greatest thing. The Mur de Huy, the finale on the Mur de Huy, is the greatest thing they've ever seen because it's so spectacular. But then after two or three editions, you've sort of seen them all, haven't you? You know, it's always a fight for position to the bottom of the Mur de Huy, whatever sort of posturing, attacking goes on before then, and then it's about who is the strongest and who times their effort the best, and it's always a variation on the same theme, isn't it? And as Lionel who Napalm, who we like to refer to him, we've started to refer to him by his proper nickname, Napalm, for reasons which will be disclosed in a future podcast.
We'll put that information behind the paywall so that people sign up as friends to hear it. Yeah.
As he has said on numerous occasions, the three finales, Amstel, Flesch and Liège, are also very, very similar. They finish up a short climb, 1-2 kilometres long. Liège slightly different, not quite so hard, the final climb to Amstel. Amstel has also changed. It doesn't finish at the top of the Kooiberg anymore. It's slightly beyond that, a kilometre or so beyond that. However, there is a sort of alarming, recurring pattern of the same riders winning all three, or certainly contending in all three. And so it's three variations on the same theme in a week, isn't it?
And the form rider, clearly, Valverde, who was second at Amstel. I mistakenly said last week in last week's podcast that he was third at Amstel. He was second there, then first at Flesch Wallon, first at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. So clearly the in-form rider. And maybe that highlights a problem, that a rider in that sort of form, maybe the race doesn't have the sort of tactical intricacy that the other races have, in that a rider in form like that can just sort of dominate in the way that Valverde has done.
Yeah, but Valverde's not a tactical numpty, is he, either? I mean, he's 35 years old, and is that right? He's 35, I think? And seemingly riding better than ever, which is a very uncomfortable thing to watch. Kind of goes to the heart of the difficulty of watching 21st century cycling, isn't it?
Well, the difficulty of watching Valverde in particular. He is a Marmite cyclist, isn't he?
And referred to in this morning's L'Equipe by Julien Alaphilippe, who was second, as a monster of cycling who seems to get better every year, which I thought was... it was either disingenuous or very well observed.
I mean, it's funny though, isn't it? Because the way that we discuss and celebrate or not celebrate a Valverde win is, it does lay you open to the charge of hypocrisy. Because if you don't mention Valverde's past and his 2-year ban for doping and his implication in Operation Puerto, you're turning a blind eye, you're sweeping it under the carpet.
You've just mentioned it.
But if you do mention it, you are singling him out and you're treating him differently to the way that you treat other riders who've done exactly the same. Some have been caught and some haven't been caught.
And the charge that's often levelled at us in that case, or the observation that's often made about Valverde, is that he has shown no contrition. But on the other hand, at least he hasn't sort of given lip service to this clamour for a grovelling, sort of weaselly apology, which is also insincere. At least by not giving any real sort of apology or not appearing contrite, he's probably reflected his own feelings about the whole thing, which was he did what everyone else was doing. And, you know, morally, there were good reasons to do what he did, but in terms of, you know, we've mentioned it before, he made a better life for himself, he became very rich, his children probably go to very good schools, etc., etc. So
expensive hair, weave.
Yeah, which hasn't really worked very well.
It is possible that Alejandro Valverde is training, that, you know, he's actually approaching his professional life as an athlete with a great deal more seriousness and application and science and investment than, you know, when he was up to nefarious business and, you know, resulting in a 2-year doping ban.
I think there's every reason to suspect.
So that, you know, that's the generous interpretation. The fact of the matter is, unless Alejandro Valverde were a guest on the podcast and were in full, frank, open confessional mode, only one man knows, and that's Alejandro Valverde. So, you know, we're shooting in the dark, really, here. I think it's a legitimate response, at least, to watch Liège-Bastogne-Liège and the Flesch, and to grimace at the sight of Alejandro Valverde winning and turn the telly off. I mean, I kind of understand why cycling fans do that, and I think that's a fair enough response. I mean, I had to write a magazine column recently. Someone asked me for a July edition, for a Tour de France edition. Someone said, can you write in 1,000 words why you should still watch cycling on the telly, why you should still tune in and watch the Tour de France? And I kind of tried to make this distinction between the live experience of the flag dropping and the finish line, and watch that race and enjoy it, and then, you know, as soon as the arms are raised in celebration or slump in defeat, that's when rushing in to fill that vacuum is precisely the kind of conversation we're having now. You need, as a cycling fan, to be very clever and nuanced and to be able to separate those two things, the live race and then everything else, all the baggage that goes with it. However, I wrote that column kind of believing my own words, but it is tricky. Granted, it is tricky. When you kind of knew Valverde was going to win that race, and it was a slightly unedifying sight. I would go that far, yeah.
Just on doping and the sort of accusation we're levelling at these races of being boring now, I think there's been a trend in the last few years, or the last 10 years, to make Liège harder and harder. And climb like La Redoute has become pretty much an irrelevance now. It comes about 50 kilometres from the finish. Nothing really ever happens there. In the sort of much lamented EPO years of the 90s, that was really a high point of the strategic high point of the race, a very exciting point of the race. It isn't anymore. But just looking at some of the riders' Strava files from yesterday, looking at the altitude gain in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, is over 4,100 metres now. And it's possible that it is just too hard. And we've seen the last few years, very little happening until the last couple of climbs. And it does sometimes look as though people are scared of gambling before the last sort of 15, 20 kilometres. I'm just comparing here the Liège course to some of the world championships of the last 20, 30 years. And it's really up there. It would be up there with the very hardest world championship courses that we've ever seen. Duitama in Colombia in 1995, Sallanches in France in 1980. They're the only two world championship courses in the last 40 years which are actually more difficult in terms of altitude gain than in Liège. So, you know, perhaps instead of adding climbs, what Christian Prudhomme and the organiser ASO should be doing is taking some away and maybe opening the race to different tactical scenarios.
And maybe not finishing in Liège, which from the helicopter shots is the ugliest city in Europe. You do really question, don't you, the value, the touristic value of Liège chipping into the coffers, getting this prestigious race and then showing its arse to the world.
People, the armpit of Belgium. People who've never been to Liège think it sounds like a beautiful place, doesn't it, Liège? And of course, we were there for the tour start in 2012 and we say just outside Liège, and it was beautiful. The countryside around there is lovely.
The cobbled square's all right in the middle, but the race doesn't finish anywhere near there, does it? It's grim.
From the cobbles of Belgium to the tops of the Alps, you're listening to the Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Freeb.
Okay, we're still talking Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and beyond Valverde, there was certainly a notable performance in all the Ardennes Classics from, do we include the Amstel Gold Race? We had this debate last year. It's not an Ardennes Classic, but we kind of include it as part of the Ardennes chapter. But Julien Alaphilippe, the young Frenchman, 21 years old, Etix Quick Step, there's obviously going to be huge interest in him. Now he was second at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. As you say, Daniel, it's got to be one of the hardest, if not the hardest, one-day race in the world. So for a rider of that age to ride so well. And, you know, he wasn't somebody who just popped up at the end either. He was pretty active in the final 15, 20 kilometres. He looked strong throughout. An amazing performance.
Yeah, and it could be argued that he would have ridden even better and perhaps won both Flesch and Liège had he not had to look out for his team captain, Michał Kwiatkowski.
I'll stop you there, Daniel, because we've had a Facebook message from a Polish listener, I was going to say reader there. He has given us, he's broken it down into four syllables. Kwiatkowski. I can do all four syllables.
That's three syllables.
Michał Kwiatkowski.
No, Kwiatkowski.
It's not hard. Kwiatkowski.
Okay, we'll carry on with that. He did pronounce his own name for us during the tour last year. Our Polish listener suggested that he didn't quite pronounce it correctly. Anyway, do go on, Daniel.
Yeah, so Alaphilippe, we're fairly sure how that's pronounced. He spent a lot of the, certainly Flesch and Liège, looking over his shoulder to see where Kwiatkowski was. The thing is, I'm the only one here with any Polish heritage, aren't I? And I'm the only one getting it spectacularly wrong. Anyway, he probably wasted or used up quite a bit of energy looking out for Kwiatkowski. And the Polish guy, the world champion, his Etix teammates. And yeah, that perhaps took some of the edge off his sprint, but as you say, Rich, for a second-year pro, a guy who's never ridden a Grand Tour, often riders talk about the sort of added endurance, the added staying power they get once they've come out of their first Grand Tour. He's never ridden a Grand Tour. He's going to ride the Vuelta later this year. It's quite extraordinary. Another quite amazing thing about Alaphilippe is that when he turned professional, or when he was picked up by Etix's development team a couple of years ago, it was the only offer he had from any French team or development team, which is a pretty poor indictment, really, when you think of the number of French teams that there are, elite French teams, and their sort of desperation to unearth new talent, particularly.
There's inevitably going to be interest from French teams now, so is he going to go to Cofidis?
I would doubt it. I mean, he said in L'Equipe today that he's very, very grateful for precisely that reason to Etix, because, you know, they gave him an offer when no one else was really interested. Also interesting in that he's not someone who's grown up really watching the classics, showing any great interest in the classics. He said he watched Flesch Wallon for the first time in 2011, so only 4 years ago. His first Flesch he saw was won by
in the Flesch.
Yes, won by Philippe Gilbert. He's very much a sort of easy breezy character. He's not the kind of guy who gets very stressed, certainly not in races or out of races. Doesn't seem to succumb to any great pressure, and certainly based on his performances this week, I think he'll be a factor for the next probably decade in those races.
I was hoping we might see, talking about youngish French talent, I thought we might see a little bit more of Tony Galloper in the Ardennes. He was pretty invisible, wasn't he, which was a shame. Also,
so Romain Bardet.
That was the one, yeah.
In Liège.
He looked good, didn't he?
Good to see him have a go. I mean, it may well do Alaphilippe quite a lot of good to not be on a French team, I would suggest. Wouldn't you think there'd be a pressure for them to chuck him into the Tour de France?
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly been helped by the strength of the Etics team as well. It would have been difficult to envisage a rider in a French team, you know, finishing second in their first.
It does create a situation with Kwiatkowski, and he's 24 years old, a huge talent, one Amstel Gold race.
This is where we have to unscoop ourselves.
Well, I mean,
last week's revelation.
There was a rumour last year from Daniel last week, he was on the radar of Team Sky. He said that he's committed to Etics. That may or may not be true.
He said in the press today that he would like to stay at Etics. We did stress that it was a rumour, didn't we?
I'm not sure if we did that.
The rumour Kwiatkowski to Sky has been going around for a few weeks. I know that Mark Cavendish, who's a very good friend with the pole, the world champion, he confronted him directly with this rumour and said, "Are you going to Sky?" And Kwiatkowski said, "No, it's just a rumour for the moment."
Interesting. But you wonder, you know, accommodating both those guys, Alaphilippe and Kwiatkowski, gives them a very strong sort of Ardennes team. But you also wonder whether Kwiatkowski is the right horse to back, because I think that he was not a lucky winner, that would be too strong, but he was fortunate at the Amstel Gold Race. He, you know, when the attack came from Philippe Gilbert, he couldn't go with him, and he was lucky that it sort of came back together and he popped out and won the sprint. Very impressive and all the rest of it, but I don't think he's shown in these races the sort of form that we might have expected from him.
And I think we've mentioned it before in the podcast, the big issue and the big challenge for him in the next few years of his career is nailing down exactly what his identity is as a rider, particularly given what we've said about the Ardennes Classics and them not really capturing the imagination. Is that enough of a focus? Is that enough of a speciality for someone who is now regarded as one of the sort of Galacticos of world cycling? Is that going to be enough to motivate him and also satisfy a sponsor who presumably, when he does sign his next contract, is going to be paying him a seven-figure fee?
I asked him about that when he was in the leader's jersey at the Tour of Britain last autumn, a week before he went on to win the rainbow jersey. I asked him precisely about that point. How do you, you know, where do you see yourself as a rider in 5 years from now? He's so young, you forget that, because he's been a name at the highest level for a number of years now.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Thanks to our sponsors, Van Dessel Cycles and British Eurosport. Coming up on the Home of Cycling in the next week or so, from the 1st to the 3rd of May, live coverage of the Tour de Yorkshire. Then from the 6th to the 10th of May, Tour of Azerbaijan. And 6th to 10th of May, also live coverage of the 4 days of Dunkirk. And we're not far away now from the Giro d'Italia, which will be covered live on British Eurosport from the 9th to the 31st of May. It's thanks to Van Dessel, British Eurosport, and the friends of the podcast. Our weekly episodes are free. Remember that you can become a friend for £5, which gains you access to our first three friends specials. And please, if you have signed up and not heard from us, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. All our email addresses are there. And please get in touch with any queries at all about the Friends podcast.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Download old episodes absolutely free at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Okay, let's leave the Ardennes behind, and we're into sort of stage race season now. Tour de Romandie is going on at the moment, but there was also news last week, as Lionel alluded to, on Astana. This might be the sort of final chapter in this particular story, or in this installment, in this volume. So Astana are not going to be stripped of their World Tour license. They are free to race. Had they been stripped by the UCI License Commission of their license, it would have probably not meant a great deal initially, because I'm sure it would have been appealed to CAS, and in interim they would have been allowed to carry on racing. As it is, that's over, that's finished. Now, it did raise, there are probably more still a lot of questions around that. One of the questions I have actually about it is the recommendation, or the notion of a couple of months ago, that the UCI should strip Astana of their licence, owed much to the audit that was carried out by the University of Lausanne. Now, they were appointed towards the end of last year to carry out an audit, an investigation into Team Astana. And they reported back in, I think it was February, wasn't it, Daniel? From what I understand, a lot of the study was conducted online or in interviews with previous riders and so on. From what I understand, it doesn't seem to me that they really got under the skin of what goes on at Team Astana now. And I think that's what we should be probably focused on and concentrating on rather than that team's history, because the team does have a dirty history. But surely what's relevant here is what is the culture in the team now? What was the culture in the team in 2014?
I don't think it ever really set out to unearth a smoking gun, or I don't think the people compiling the report ever thought they were going to uncover one. It was more sort of analysis of the managerial structures that are in place in Astana and an assessment of the scope there would be in theory for doping and such practices. A lot of the conclusions that the commission drew were to do with the amount of contact the management has with riders, the amount of contact the doctors have with riders, whether the sort of scrutiny and of the riders was sort of stringent enough, really.
I think it's a great idea, this, an audit and investigators in teams, but I think they would have to do it over the course of a season or certainly a longer period of time. It was a suggestion that Dave Brailsford made, of course, to the Cycling Podcast, that the UCI appoint independent investigators to live with teams, rotate them around so they don't get close to any teams. I think there's a lot of merit in that, but it has to be done. It has to be done properly, I think. Unrelated to the news about Astana last week was the little story that erupted concerning Fabio Aru, who will lead Astana at the Giro d'Italia. And there was a bit of a kerfuffle when Greg Henderson, the New Zealand rider, wrote a couple of tweets suggesting that Fabio Aru's withdrawal from the Giro del Trentino was not illness-related, as was reported, but actually something a little bit more sinister. Daniel.
Hail Mary, another Hail Mary. Well, he suggested that there were problems with Aru's biological passport, didn't he? Which, to be honest, is a rumour that has been going around, at this stage, a scurrilous rumour that's been going around for several months. It's an allegation that shouldn't be made on Twitter. It's an allegation that if Greg Henderson wants to make it, or if he has any intelligence information directly related to that, he should go straight to the UCI. He didn't do that. Therefore, Fabio Aru and his management are perfectly entitled to take the action that I believe they are taking, perhaps sue Greg Henderson. And the UCI should really fine him as well, fine him or sanction him in some way. But I'm not suggesting that he should be banned. I'm sure that would leave them open to...
Can you imagine the headlines?
Well, exactly. I can imagine.
The UCI punished Greg Henderson for alleging that someone's doping on Twitter. Can you imagine?
Yeah, it would leave them open to allegations of the old omerta, wouldn't it?
I mean, it's enormously important that this is a very, very difficult thing to talk about, isn't it? Because none of us know whether Aru's been doping or not. But, you know, let's just kind of take it in the abstract. So incredibly important that riders who have information or even just well-founded suspicions are given a mechanism and an obligation to make use of that mechanism. Because if the culture's got to change, it's got to change from within the peloton. So coming down on Greg Henderson like a ton of bricks through the courts and by sanctions within the UCI seems to me to be probably the wrong response and would discourage. I totally take your point. Twitter is not the right way to have gone about that. But it strikes me this is a really serious issue and potentially an opportunity for the UCI to put in place a structure that would actually work, you know, for riders to... and a culture that would encourage them to
because it's,
to rat on each other is not the right, you know, that would be the.
I think it's important to stress that there's so many of these rumours, yeah. You know, that, and most of them are probably not true.
Yes.
And you can hear rumours.
Greg Henderson's not a stupid man, is he? And he's quite Twitter active and has been, you know, he's slipped up here big time, obviously. My suspicion is that something's driven him to make that remark, and that needs a different, you know, escape valve, doesn't it?
I would still, and I don't know at all, but I would imagine that given the context, given the team, given the headlines about that team recently, that can all influence how you regard a rumour. You know, context is everything. And we hear rumours all the time, and whether we treat them seriously or not can often depend on these quite arbitrary things.
In Aru's case, I would say that...
Or they can be arbitrary.
Well, in Aru's case and in Astana's case in general, with regard to Nibali as well, I think there's an element of casual racism as well. I think non-English speakers are treated sort of in a more cavalier fashion when it comes to spreading rumours than you know, the Anglophile riders. But also, I think it's worth pointing out that Henderson here is talking about the biological passport. Now, we know how nebulous the biological passport is. We know how difficult it is to bring cases, how difficult it is for people with decades of experience to analyse, the UCI panel put in place to analyse the parameters. So for a rider to make an allegation on that, either he has access to some kind of leak and a case is imminent and is going to be brought against Aru, we have no reason to suggest that, or he has got his information based on guesswork, or possibly, you know, we know certain teams now, when they're looking to sign a rider, they take a look at rider's biological passport. Has the information come from there? But otherwise, it's very, very difficult to imagine what sort of concrete information this has come on the basis of.
Tell us about Aru, though, Daniel. I mean, he's shown flashes of genius, brilliance this year. Nothing to suggest that he's going to be podium contender at the Giro, really.
Aru, in the last two seasons, has actually raced very, very little and spent an awful lot of time at altitude. The programme that was laid out for him was, I think, 20 race days before the Giro d'Italia, which, by comparison with other Giro contenders, is a very small number.
He rode Pyrenees, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
And he was on the attack a little bit. Nothing to set the heather on fire.
No. And this habit he has of spending an awful lot of time at altitude, you can imagine that probably makes his biological passport even more difficult to interpret. However, over the last week, following this sort of outburst from Greg Henderson, there's been a fair amount of speculation and a sort of dot joining about Aru's past, the time he spent as an amateur under amateur team manager in Italy called Olivano Locatelli, who has a shady past, to say the least. He was the manager who's nurtured Yaroslav Popovic, Giampaolo Caruso, various others. In 2003, he was a direct supporter of the Lambu Credit Cornago team. He was arrested on the basis of phone taps. All sorts of stories, kind of fairly unedifying stories about Olivano Locatelli bullying riders in the late 90s, hiding riders' food. He used to carry out spot checks in training camps and find Mars bars hidden under mattresses and subject riders to pretty gruesome punishments. late night training rides, 200 kilometre training rides, when he found a Mars bar under one of their mattresses. So that is Olivano Locatelli, and you know, the association has been made with Aru. Aru spent a couple of years. Locatelli really discovered Aru in the, I think it was the 2010 or 11 Giro delle Regioni. Aru was a cyclocross rider at the time. People who know the Italian amateur scene very well will tell you that Locatelli was the worst of the worst in the late 90s and early noughties. Subsequent to his arrest in 2003, and there was a period of house arrest, he came back sort of on tiptoes, has a much smaller team now in the Italian amateur cycling team than he did at the time, is a much more low-profile figure, and they also suggest that he has changed his ways and seen the light as far as ethics and anti-doping are concerned. But given what Henderson said, this is certainly an element of Aru's past that people have highlighted in the last week.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
Tour of Yorkshire.
De Yorkshire.
Tour de Yorkshire. Well, that's a contentious point, isn't it? Is it the Tour de Yorkshire?
It's the Tour de Yorkshire. It's not contentious at all, like the Tour de Georgia.
But it's slightly ridiculous, isn't it, Bolton?
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous, but that's what it is. It's the Tour de Yorkshire. Believe me, that's what we'll be calling it on the telly.
Or the Tour de Trump, or in the 90s, the Tour DuPont stage race in America became the Tour de Trump when it was sponsored by Donald Trump. That's maybe even more ridiculous.
I was thinking, though, that you're talking about the Anglophone world and the kind of associated problems with that. What do we call things like the Flèche Wallonne in English?
Flèche Wallonne.
Flèche Wallonne. The Arrow of Wallonia. Mm. You can't, can you?
No, you can't.
You can't do that.
No, you call it the Flèche Wallonne. That's what it's called. Listen, we'll talk about it. I think we're heading, all of us,
to the Brabantspiel.
The Valspiel.
Yeah, the Brabantspiel. What do you call that?
What you just said.
Flesh Brabazon.
The Flesh Brabazon.
Okay, we're all heading to Yorkshire, I think, to the snow.
Are you going to Yorkshire?
Daniel's going to Yorkshire.
Have you ever been to Yorkshire before?
I went to Yorkshire to write a feature on Yorkshire League village cricket a few years ago. Yeah, I think that was the only time I've ever been.
Full of casual racism.
Hang on, Daniel, you were there last year.
Casual.
You were there last year for the Tour of France. For the Tour of France in Yorkshire. For the big start of the Tour of France. Now, before we talk about this curious new race in a lot of ways, let's hear from Gary Verity, Mr. Cycling in Yorkshire, who brought the Tour de France.
Gary Truth.
Brilliant. Him and his friend Christian Proudman. Yeah. He did a lot to bring the Tour de France to Yorkshire, and he is also heavily involved in the new Tour de Yorkshire. I was up there recently, rode actually stage one, which is absolutely savage. The climbs and the unrelenting roads. There's a level crossing as well with about 30 miles to race. And a steam train goes up and down that, and the steam train is apparently going to go alongside the peloton at some point.
Bit of uncertainty about whether that will finish in a bunch sprint or not.
Well, having ridden it, I've had this conversation with Ned before. Whenever you ride these or see these courses, you think, no way this is going to end in a sprint. I think we thought that about stage one of the Tour de France last year as well. But it probably will, because these things have a habit of coming back together and being quite controlled.
I've been asking, canvassing opinion amongst the domestic pros, the Conti riders, of whom plenty are riding. There's, six continental teams. And it's funny, because all the domestic pros say, no way is that going to be a bunch sprint. It'll be a small group who come to the finish line. But I suspect it'll be a very big group.
Well, let's talk about the race in a moment. Let's hear first from Gary Verity about this inaugural Tour de Yorkshire.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast and British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Gary Verity, Mr. Cycling Yorkshire. We've just ridden part of stage one of Tour de Yorkshire. We got pretty much everything that they could throw at us. We got wind, a bit of rain, a bit of hail. You were very lucky last year with the Tour de France, a Grand Départ, with the weather. Is it going to hold this year for the Tour de Yorkshire?
Who knows? Early May, you could get anything. I promised Christian Prudhomme, who's our co-organiser for this race, obviously, that in the first 25 years of it, the first 25 editions, we'll get all kinds of weather. I said to him, definitely we'll get floods, we'll get gale force winds, we'll get droughts, we'll get heat waves, we'll get a bit of snow. I just can't tell you which year it'll come in. Hopefully this year it'll be good to get some good weather with it being the first edition. I suspect we'll get very big crowds for it, but a lot of that, as with all outdoor events, will be down to the weather.
Are you happy with the lineup? It's been confirmed the last couple of weeks. 5 World Tour teams, Bradley Wiggins obviously riding with his new team. Are you happy with the composition of the field, the mix of continental and British teams?
Yeah, I think so. We've got 8 British teams, got 8 teams that will be doing the Tour de France this time. We've got, for the spectators, we've got a lot of teams that they'll recognise, not just the British teams, but teams they'll recognise from the Tour de France who were here last year, you know, Cofidis, Europcar, BMC, Giant Alpecin, Team Sky, obviously. So that's good, and we're really pleased that we've confirmed, obviously, Team Wiggins and Sir Bradley, injuries permitting and everything, will be at the start. And one of the big, for me, one of the biggest personalities in the peloton, Marcel Kittel. Obviously, a winner twice in the UK with the Tour last year. Winner of Stage 1, as everyone will remember, with Cavs crashed on the finish line in just before the finish line in Harrogate. If Marcel is fit and starts for us, then I would think he must be one of the favourites for Stage 2, certainly the very flat stage into York.
It's a legacy event, obviously, following the Grand Départ last year. How long is our ASO committed to running this event for? Do you know?
We've signed a contract with them for 10 years, which is a joint venture between us. But, you know, we want the thing to go on in perpetuity.
That's a big commitment, though, time-wise. Is it because, obviously, the Tour de France Yorkshire was a huge success, but Britain is an emerging market in cycling? ASO, obviously, hold events in Qatar and Oman and all over the world. Is Britain quite an important place for them, do you think, looking into the future?
Yeah, I think both of those things are true. I think it's down to, obviously, the success of the Yorkshire Grand Départ last year and also to the boom in British cycling. You know, cycling seems to be on an exponential curve, a growth curve that is just, you know, when will it stop? Who knows? You know, more people cycling more often, bike sales up, the better weather is starting to arrive now. You'll see more and more people out cycling. The Tour de Yorkshire will really give cycling, again, another big boost in the UK. Who knows where it will go on for, but clearly for ASO, you know, they are embroiled in all things positive in cycling. They organise most of the big races in the world, and certainly many of the most important races in the world, and we want this to be in the mix with those.
Organising the Tour de France is one thing. The fact that it's the Tour de France, I guess, opens doors, smooths out problems in terms of logistics and so on. You've got ASO on board with this, but have there been additional challenges given that it's not the Tour de France?
Absolutely. But, you know, for us, when we were choosing a partner who we wanted to organise the race with, I think ASO are the best in the business at what they do. If you look at the organisation for the Tour de France, it is in a league of its own because of the scale of it. But having worked behind the scenes with them and seen how they operate behind the scenes, not just on the Tour de France, but on Paris-Roubaix, on Liège-Bastogne-Liège, etc., etc., they're a class act. My background is running businesses and turning businesses around that need to do better. And so I've seen, you know, experiences of management, good and bad, firsthand. And I can tell you they're a class act at what they do. So for us, organising this with them is a very positive experience, but it comes with a different set of challenges to the Tour de France. You know, we have to manage everyone's expectation that it's not the Tour de France. So, you know, you're not going to get a publicity caravan, you're not on closed roads, you're on rolling road closures pretty much all the way around, with one or two exceptions. And so the scale of the thing is different. Obviously, it doesn't have the same media circus coming with it. There won't be 2,500 journalists coming with this event. It'll be a couple of hundred journalists, but that's, which is still significant. But it's a different scale, and obviously the media entourage with it in terms of the television coverage. We'll be in 120 countries around the world, which is still significant, but it's not 190. So everything about it is on a slightly different scale. But our ambition for the event, and ASO's ambition for the event, and British Cycling's ambition for the event is very strong, and we want to make the men's race the best kind of event of its type in the world. It won't happen this year, but it'll take a few years to establish that. We want to do that, and we want to build up the women's event as well. We've got a women's race obviously this year, but you know, it'd be great to see that build over the years. So the Tour de France was the start of a journey in the next chapter of Yorkshire cycling. We've launched bike libraries now, where our ambition over the next 4 or 5 years is that every child in the county should have access to a bicycle, no matter their social background. So that one of the important parts of our legacy, if we are to become and fulfil our stated aim of being the European capital of cycling, is to have a top quality annual pro race here, besides the Tour de France coming through from time to time, etc., etc.
So when's the tour going to come back to Yorkshire?
I don't know. I would like to think it could come back on the 10th anniversary of it being here last year, so that'll be 2024. I hope still to be alive and fit enough to see it. If not, you'll be reporting on it and talking to somebody else.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah,
I'd to be alive for that.
Yeah, you'll be here for sure for it. I hope. I might be, but you never know. I don't take anything for granted.
Lionel, where are we?
Where are we, Lionel?
Lionel, where are we?
Where are we, Lionel?
Stay cool this summer with your exclusive Cycling Podcast t-shirt. Each t-shirt features a classic Cycling Podcast moment, a terrible joke, or pay homage to some of the friends of the podcast, including Christian Prudhomme.
Beautiful landscapes, passion for cycling, passion for a tour, French flags, British flags, yellow flags, bunting.
Roger de Vlaminck.
Where did Sean Kelly come in the 2005 wife carrying world championship?
He didn't, but he does own donkeys.
And Chiro.
No, I'm not in Great Britain, I must confess. Yes, but no, I must confess, no.
The t-shirts are available in a range of colours for just £19. Get your Cycling Podcast t-shirt at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Okay, I'll go for Brian Cockar.
I spoke to him after the finish. He's a very, I hesitate to use the word spunky, but... Hey, Lionel. Back in your kennel.
Bunting. So we heard there from Gary Verity, Mr. Cycling Yorkshire, and I was up there just to ride stage one, or not all of it, it's part of it. We had hoped actually to meet up with Ned Bolting, who was undertaking his own Tour de Yorkshire at the time. You'd ridden the stages not in order, but unfortunately you had gone home by the time I got there.
I cried off. I was going to ride stage one the day you did. The two previous days I'd ridden stage two, which is ostensibly the Saturday stage, which is ostensibly the straightforward one. It's not entirely straightforward, but that will be a bunch of sprints, I would imagine. And stage three, which is anything. But, I mean, we talked about Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and you were talking about 4,000 metres of climbing, 3,000 metres on stage three of the Yorkshire Tour. And a very similar kind of, you know, sharp, you know, it's up and down the valleys of the Pennines where you just drop straight down with difficult descents that allow you no respite, really. And then you kick into these villages and straight back up the other side in these crazy little gradients. All day, yeah. You know, that's what stage three is like.
It's very hard, and I remember the stage to Sheffield, the Tour de France last year, that was won by Vincenzo Nibali. Of course, people did compare that to sort of mini Liège-Bastogne-Liège before the race run. That's what the roads are like there. I rode part of that that stage with Sean Kelly, and the highlight of the day actually was getting Sean Kelly to wear a "Where Are We, Lionel" T-shirt, and I think British Eurosport will be tweeting that soon. And offering the T-shirt up as a prize. Anyway, That's a little reminder, by the way, that our T-shirts are available. Ned, you'll have to select a T-shirt. We'll pay you for your contribution this week with a T-shirt. That's also for all previous contributions and all future ones. Is that okay?
Yeah, great.
Any T-shirt in particular you want?
I don't really want one. It's all right.
Okay. Scandalous. You will wear a T-shirt, Ned. Right, okay, the race itself, it's a curious race in a way. It's a three-day stage race at a time when we are going from the classics into the stage racing calendar. It's not a race that you're going to ride if you're riding the Tour de Romandie because it clashes, or the Tour of Turkey because it clashes, or if you're heading building up to the Giro because it's coming quite soon. So we've got Marcel Kittel, we've got Bradley Wiggins, we've got Team Sky, but who is this race for?
I don't know. We're going to find out. And that's one of the great pleasures of it, I think, the inaugural race, because it's very hard to call. The proportion of World Tour teams to Pro Conti teams and Conti teams is a bit skewed as well. There are a lot of Pro Conti teams, and as I said, six, because they originally left two of the domestic teams out and had to, you know, wrongly, and had to, within a week, they'd done an about-face and added two more teams. Eight-man teams as well. So a peloton of 148 riders or something. A lot will be the outcome of the race will be partly determined by the weather and partly by the attitude and the purpose of the World Tour teams and what they hope to be getting out of it. I mean, Kittel is interesting because he's barely raced. He raced in, was it Qatar or Dubai? I think it was Qatar. And that was it. I mean, he raced down under and won a stage of the Herald Sun Tour, whatever it's called.
Well, he won the opening, the curtain raising crit. It was not even a proper stage of the race.
And that's been it. Now, The team's line on Kittel's season so far is that he's been suffering from a long, debilitating kind of viral thing that he can't get rid of, and that's knocked him back. That may, I'm sure, be true, and probably is the case. You also hear slightly unsettling stuff about him taking on an awful lot of sponsors' responsibilities and not having his mind totally on the job, and, you know.
Interesting that's the team's line, because that's not Mark Cavendish's line.
What's Mark?
I think Cavendish draws parallels with his experience in 2010. He had an incredibly successful 2009, had an awful lot to do that winter. And, you know, this is not exclusive to Cavendish, this phenomenon of just, you know, the more successful you become, the more difficult it gets to reconcile your training obligations with other obligations. And that just becomes a fact of life. And that is the next big hurdle in any successful young rider's career. And you know, often it takes, there's a period, for some it's 6 months, for some it's a year, for some it's 2 years to actually become accustomed to that and to learn to manage it. And perhaps that's what Kittel's experiencing now, we don't know.
This can be more of a problem, you know, not to make any judgments about Kittel, but he's a big fella who, you know, when he's in top form, top condition, It's a bit of a struggle for him to finish the Grand Tour, to get through these mountain stages, you know, without having a decent sort of base this year. Going to the Tour, he's going to struggle even more, you would think. And I think he could even struggle at the Tour de Yorkshire in some of those climbs. I could be wrong, but, yeah. You know, you look at him and you think he's the sort of guy, sort of like Cavendish as well. Cavendish obviously struggles a bit with his weight, that he needs a lot of racing, a lot of training to be in shape. And I imagine Kittel's probably the same.
Yeah. Go back to that stage one of last year's Tour de France, though, and I think that you'll have to bear that in mind. I mean, there's every chance that he'll win stage one, Marcel Kittel, and win stage two, and then climb off halfway around stage three. He won't win the overall.
A bit like Ned Bolting.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know who'll win the race. I've got no idea. It'll be somebody fairly unpredictable, I should imagine, because the race itself, the outcome of the race, will be determined by a move getting up the road on stage three and somebody winning from a group there.
I would suggest that Ben Swift is the hot favourite. No?
Yeah. Yeah. He's got a team. I mean, it's a very... You look at the team lineup. They've got Sebastian in now. They've got bits and pieces. It's a bits and pieces kind of support team because their resources are spread. And this is one of the problems about the timing of the race. Sky's resources are spread very thin over Romandie, which is essentially the Tour de France team, isn't it? Its core. And, I don't know. The weird thing about its place in the calendar is that Christian Prudhomme originally wanted Gary Verity to take the Criterium International and to move that from Corsica to Yorkshire, which is, what, 3 weeks ago, isn't it, the Criterium International? Something like, or at least, maybe four, a month ago. Gary quite rightly pointed out that there's snow on the Pennines, every likelihood at that time of year, and he couldn't do it. But the difference between that's also a three-stage race, although that's a two-day race. But it kind of, the Criterium International in its Corsica form mirrors a kind of scrunched down Grand Tour, because you have a time trial, a kind of flat crit circuit, and then you have a very straightforward stage with a mountaintop finish.
But it's a race that's also struggling a little bit. It's got a bit of an identity crisis as well. And
but you know what every stage is about. You're kind of it's a mini training camp, if you like, for those specific riders doing that.
But it's maybe a problem with a 3-day stage race. You know what is a 3-day stage race for?
Well, we don't know really, do we? I mean, we don't know what a 3-day stage race with profiles like the Tour de Yorkshire is, because, correct me if I'm wrong, Daniel, they don't exist.
No,
and so we're about to find out, aren't we?
And we are at the back end. We're kind of, it's very much after the Lord Mayor's show as far as the classics are concerned. Greg Van Avermaet is riding in Yorkshire. He's certainly down to ride. Yeah. But you wonder what kind of form of motivation he's going to have. But really, that is the kind of rider that a race with the terrain of Yorkshire would be ideal for. And the stage race riders at this point in the year, if they want blocks of racing, they want longer blocks of racing, more mountainous blocks of racing, they'll go to Romandy. They'll wait until California, etc. So it does have that problem. It'll be interesting to see just how it finds its identity in the next, well, certainly with this edition and the next few years.
It will also be interesting to see what it's like, an ASO-organised race in Great Britain. And it was interesting to hear Gary Verity say in our interview that they've committed for 10 years.
Amazing.
Which is amazing. I don't know what that exactly involves or means, but there's certainly a long-term plan there, it seems, to develop something in Britain. And this is something that's been rumoured for a while. They tried to take over the Tour of Britain when that went out to tender. They bid for the Tour of Britain and didn't get it. I don't know how serious they were about that, but one thing we know about ASO is they know how to organise bike races, and it brings a certain kudos to it, doesn't it?
Do we know whether or how seriously they considered a one-day race? Obviously, there used to be the Leeds Classic on similar terrain, I guess, to what we're going to see on stage three, based on a lot of the same roads. And, that is one obvious solution to this problem of finding a place in calendar, finding the kind of riders that are going to be suited to that sort of race.
I don't know the answer to that, but I will tell you, because television plays its role in these things, and especially terrestrial television, when they get involved, like ITV are getting involved with this one, stage racing, even if it's only 3 days, does better than one of the reasons that I've been told that ITV are not so, they have very mixed messages about getting involved in the classics, is they, to the casual sports fan and cycling fan, they pop up and they're gone within a day, and it's kind of whereas stage racing builds an audience and builds a loyalty, that's why the women's tour went straight onto nightly highlights, and the Tour of Britain grows and grows.
We like our narratives, don't we?
Yeah, we like our narratives. But going back to, the Tour of Britain and ASO's frustration, perhaps, about not being able to wrestle control of that and seeing it grow in the way it has done, that's a good template, isn't it? Because that, I think, 10 years ago was struggling to find an identity. It had time bonuses on the line, so sprinters were winning it by winning three stages and kind of didn't really. But it certainly does. The last 2 or 3 years of the Tour of Britain, it's got a proper place in the calendar now and fulfills, most importantly, it fulfills a function, doesn't it, for the big name teams and the big name riders. And this is what is interesting and remains to be seen about Yorkshire.
And it takes time, and that, the 10-year commitment is interesting from that point of view, that they might, that they're going to take a view on it. The race might even expand. Who knows? There's nothing perhaps to stop that happening.
And I think the key factor is the one you mentioned there, Ned, the slot in the calendar for the Tour of Britain. Because the Tour of Britain has become very successful in spite of major complications and major negatives about that race. I'm talking specifically about the transfers, which have been mocked in the past. And the situation on that front has got better. They're not as bad as they once were. But still, you often get 2-3 hour drives after every stage, which are the kind of thing that riders really get pretty annoyed about, generally speaking. But they're willing to make the sacrifice because it is in the perfect place in the calendar for the World Championships.
They like racing here, though. I mean, if you're going to do a race that's well attended. Yeah. So it's For a first edition, it's, you know, you look at the field that's lining up, and it's I suppose to be critical, it's a little bit bereft of stardust. Tommy Voeckler will be there, pleasing the crowd.
Bradley Wiggins.
Well, how come we haven't mentioned him?
What can we expect from Bradley Wiggins?
Well, he'll ride around a bit, won't he, in his Rafa jersey. How did they come up with a name for the team?
I think the Wiggins name has a certain amount of credibility, or, you know, it's going to attract attention, isn't it, on the basis of its name.
Let's just rein in the cynicism a little bit here, and you know, it's quite obvious what this is about. This is about you only need to see the front cover of Cycling Weekly last week that said "Thank you, Sir Brad," or whatever it did on the front cover. There is quite rightly, there's a large rump of sort of cycling support in this country that is enjoying bidding him farewell after his good effort at Paris-Roubaix and his outstanding career. I mean, it is kind of remarkable. You go onto his Wikipedia page and you actually look at what he's won. It is extraordinary, and this is what the 3 days in Yorkshire are partly about. But they're not the end, are they? Because it'll presumably turn out for the Tour of Britain, as well as a few stages of the Tour series as well, the crit races, I'm led to believe.
It's a brilliantly choreographed sort of retirement, isn't it? Don't forget the Hull 10 in June, which, I was at the 3 days of Depan, and at the end there was a little huddle of Belgian journalists, and Wiggins was in very good form, actually, and giving one of his funny interviews. And they said, you know, will this be the last time trial that you do, Bradley, in your World Champions jersey? And he said, no, I think I'm doing the Hull 10 on June the 16th. And they were, like, jotting down very seriously in their notebooks, you know, hold 10 or something. And I got, they all came up to me after and says, what is this hold 10? And I think he was winding them up.
The hull for Peel. No?
Yeah.
Is that not what you told them?
Yeah. The hull arrow. Yeah. No, I'm not sure if he's seen that or not, but he was winding them up in that way that he does sometimes.
Your mate, Linus Girdeman's coming to Yorkshire as well.
Daniel's friend, yeah. Lady Gaga.
The cult leader. He was listed. Yeah, he was advertised on Twitter this week as the cult leader for Liège. His team, of course, is Cult Energy, but I think he has a pull out, so I'm not sure. I hope he doesn't have some kind of fitness problems which will prevent him being in Yorkshire.
Let's hope not. Well, we're all going up there. Let's report back on Yorkshire next week. Should be good fun. Might be terrible weather, but we'll report back. We'll wrap up for this week. A big thank you to Alex Adey, our producer and editor. Thank you to our sponsors, Van Dessel Cycles and British Eurosport. Lionel will be back next week. A little reminder that you can become a friend of the podcast at thiscyclingpodcast.com. That gives you access to our exclusive friends special podcast. Ned here is a friend of the podcast, aren't you, Ned? Yep. Got your fiver. And the t-shirts, so thecyclingpodcast.com at the shop, the Daniel designed t-shirts, doing a roaring trade. Someone, there are already some suggestions for new slogans, logos for the t-shirts.
Next week we're going to advertise the t-shirts with an exclusive Cycling Podcast Ibiza, Iron Napa, Summer 2015 Ministry of Sound kind of remix.
Daniel's been working hard on this last week. I don't know if you've been doing anything else, have you? Anyway, that's really something to look forward to. And all that remains for this week is to say thank you very much to Ned. Thank you, Ned.
Cheers. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.